Welcome to the Florida Roundup this week. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. And on today's show, for the full hour, we've got a closer look at the future of public education in Florida and how it could change under Governor-elect Ron DeSantis.
Education is an enormous piece of the state budget every year. Hundreds of thousands of people in the state work in the industry. Millions of Florida families send their kids to public schools each day. This week, the governor-elect got his pick for Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran. Corcoran's a familiar name if you follow Florida politics, certainly, Melissa. After all, he was Speaker of the Florida House for the past 2 years.
That's right, Tom. And in those 2 years, Corcoran helped continue to reshape Florida's public education system. He championed legislation that expands charter schools, allows state scholarship money to be used at private schools, and also laws that weaken teachers' unions. After DeSantis recommended Corcoran for the job, an editorial in the St. Augustine Record was actually headlined, "Rest in Peace, Public Education."
Now, in the meantime, the state's high school graduation is at an all-time high, over 86%, up almost 25% in the past decade, an enormous increase. The new governor pledged to spend 80% of the education budget in the classroom during his campaign, but what that exactly means is just not clear yet. We will talk with the head of the Florida Education Association in just a few minutes.
And we'll also take your calls and tweets about the future of public education here in Florida. But first, Governor-elect DeSantis was elected on a platform of school choice, expanding choice and competition when it comes to your child's education. Let's get into that as we welcome Erica Donalds. She's a member of the Governor-elect's Education Transition Committee and a former member of the Collier County School Board. Erica, thanks so much for appearing on the Florida Roundup.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And let me begin by getting your thoughts on the appointment of Richard Corcoran as the state's education commissioner. How do you see him affecting this agenda for Florida over the next several years?
Well, I'm incredibly excited about Richard Corcoran being our next education commissioner. As a parent, someone who has been a bit of a disruptor of the status quo myself, because I was dissatisfied with not having choice for my own children, I like that our state is going in the direction of expanding parental choice, and that Richard has really led the charge on that, both now as Speaker of the House and going forward as Commissioner of Education. And I think that what we'll see is not only an continued expansion of choice through his leadership, but that those competitive forces will continue to improve all public schools for all children, as we've seen over the past several years in Florida.
And certainly the idea of adding choice competition to the education playing field is what's driving the school choice movement. Let me ask you quickly as a follow-up, though, as my co-host Tom Hudson just noted, the state's high school graduation rate is at an all-time high, up almost 25% over the last decade. So at least by the looks of that metric, public education in Florida is on the upswing. So why the aggressive push toward more charter schools and allocating more tax dollars toward charter schools if, at least on the face of it, it appears that traditional public education has been doing better in Florida?
Well, I think what you'll see is over the past 20 years, we've seen an expansion of choice. And so I don't think that we can necessarily say that those greater results are in spite of additional choice, but perhaps because of additional choice, right? The competitive pressures that we've seen here over the past 20 years. However, I would not characterize it as trying to divert money away from this school to that school, because that's not the philosophy of Richard Corcoran and his supporters like myself. Our philosophy is that parents should be the ultimate decision makers as to which educational environment is going to work best for their child. If that's a traditional public school in the neighborhood, great. If it's a magnet school, great. If it's a charter school or a private school, we want to put those decisions in the hands of the people who know those children best, and that is the parents. So the philosophy is not about diverting money from here or there or going to this building or that building. It's about allowing parents more power and autonomy over their own child's education.
Erica, it's Tom Hudson, but doesn't that option for more choices lead to the logical result of changing funds around, of eating into what has been traditionally the revenue source for traditional public schools. And I just cite, for instance, the 7069 legislation that Richard Corcoran, the Speaker of the House, championed and got passed in the legislature and Governor Rick Scott signed, that allows public charter schools for the first time to have a piece of capital money, capital tax dollars that had been traditionally reserved for traditional public schools.
And that portion of the law actually was reversed the following year, but I know what you're saying. And yes, it is a rethinking of the funding mechanism for public education, but public education is not the same as public schools. And we have to rethink the mechanism that we have been utilizing for the past 100 years. We have evolved and innovated in every other industry, but we're trapped because of a funding mechanism and not being able to give parents and students the best educational options for them.
It has led to public money vouchers being able to be used by parents to choose private education resources for their students in Florida.
Yes, it has. And those parents are incredibly thrilled with those options, as has been shown in recent studies.
But doesn't that take away resources from public school parents and teachers stakeholders?
Well, I believe those resources belong to the parents and are assigned to the students, not to the system. And that's the rethinking that Richard Corcoran is looking for, a lot of our legislators are looking for, and frankly, the people of Florida are looking for, as evidenced by our last election. They don't want us to be thinking about this money as belonging to the system. It belongs to the students, and we need to do what's best for students with those funds.
Let me ask you, Erica, about Governor-elect Ron DeSantis's wish to devote 80% of public education spending in the classroom. Critics of that proposal have said that a lot of the spending on our schools is done outside of the classroom, that not everyone who works in the school system is working actually in the classroom. How do you see that being executed in Florida?
Well, as a former public school board member and a CPA for the past 16 years, I fully understand this dilemma. And I personally went through our budget here in Collier County and identified many areas where I felt that money would be better spent in the classroom or directly tied to the classroom. I think this initiative is going to be a good one for Florida and for students because it's going to force districts and the state to justify any dollars that are being utilized outside the classroom, outside or perhaps inside that 80% target. And I don't think we've really gone through that exercise as a state or as individual districts to justify the opportunity cost of each dollar that's being spent outside of the classroom versus inside.
So, Erica, what is a classroom spending? As a former member of a public school board, as a CPA, a certified public accountant, are teacher salaries considered classroom spending in your estimation?
They are. And so those that are saying teacher salaries should be our number one priority should be applauding this effort, because that could be the opportunity cost of some of these outside the classroom spending, should that money go better as a part of teacher salaries or teachers' compensation structure.
Do you think that teachers are underpaid in this state and that they need a raise?
You know, that's an interesting question, and I don't agree with the initiatives to blanket the state with one salary. As you know, I live in Collier County, and we are one of the highest paid teachers in the state. If we had the same, say, $50,000 as was thrown out there many times, that would give our teachers' starting salary a small raise. But my neighboring Hendry County, those teachers would flock to Hendry County because that's an incredible amount of money for living in a rural county. I don't agree with that. Richard Corcoran, in his opening speeches the other day, mentioned doing a study to see how affordable actually teacher salaries are in the state of Florida, and then making a determination based on regions, based on what that study says as to where that compensation really should be, because I want those teacher salaries to be competitive. I want that teachers, the profession, to be elevated. But I also believe that all teachers and all professionals should be paid according to merit and
Erica,
according to their performance.
We've got to leave it there. But thank you so much for your time. Erica Donnell's with us, member of Governor DeSantis, Governor-elect DeSantis Education Transition Committee, former member of the Collier County School Board. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, earlier this week, we spoke about the future of public schools in Florida, public education, with Frederick Ingram. He's president of the Florida Education Association. Not surprisingly, he has a very different view. Let's listen to that conversation now. Frederick Ingram, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And let me begin by asking you your response to the appointment of Richard Corcoran as state education commissioner. You've made some public statements saying you're looking forward to working with him. Still, though, most observers of this issue see school choice and charter schools, that agenda to be pursued more aggressively than even before in Florida. So how will the FEA respond to Corcoran's leadership when it comes to education in the Sunshine State?
Sure. Well, thank you very much for having me. And as it relates to the appointment of Richard Corcoran, first I have to talk about Speaker Corcoran. Speaker Corcoran, in our opinion, was not a friendly policymaker for public education. He ushered in two of the largest bills that we've seen that are against our public schools. One is HB 7069. 7069 was a bill that ushered in probably the biggest giveaway of tax dollars to our charter schools. And 7055 was a bill that went directly towards the advocacy groups like the FEA for educators all across the state. And in last year's budget, where he was the speaker, we simply had a starvation budget, 47 cents per student in new money to the 18-19 school year. So his track record is not one that is that gives us any optimism. But we did speak with Mr. Corcoran upon his appointment. And there seems to be a slightly less aggressive tone from Commissioner Corcoran. The FEA will work with anyone, and we look forward to continued dialogue, meaningful dialogue, that is going to be by for and about the success of our students.
Mr. Ingram, let me ask you, you mentioned two bills that Speaker Corcoran helped usher through the legislature and have Governor Rick Scott sign. 7055, that's the bill, I believe, that kind of lowers the threshold for a collective bargaining unit to be recognized for teachers' unions. It allows or requires teachers' unions to have at least 50% representation of their members in order to be recognized. 7069 does a lot of different things around public education. Most notably, I think you're referring to, is the ability for charter schools to have access to public capital tax dollars. So with that as a track record for now, Education Commissioner Corcoran, what gives you the optimism that he has somehow softened his rhetoric and treatment of traditional public schools in Florida?
So we're teachers. I'm a high school band director by trade, and we have to believe in things that we cannot see. We have to have hope and faith that everybody who comes into education, who comes into the public sphere of education, is going to be well-meaning and is going to do the right thing. It is our job to speak truth to power as an advocacy group for those people who give their lives every day to our to our students and communities and to parents every single day. They put it on the line. And so, you know, it is our job to be hopeful. It is our job to be optimistic, but it is also our job to insist that things are right for those people who take care of these kids every day, and for the kids, for programs that they need, for schools, for the physical plant, to have enough counselors in our schools, to have fewer tests going on. That is what we're about. We want to ensure that student success for 2.8 million children is the paramount duty of Mr. Corcoran, of the state legislature. And we have not seen that, but we look forward to continued dialogue. He is the commissioner of education, and so we have to work with him. And so we are not going to close our doors. We are not going to shirk our responsibilities. We're going to move forward. We're going to march ahead. And where we have to put leverage, we will. And where we, see common ground, we will try to meet Commissioner Corcoran wherever that is.
Will you try to apply leverage to Governor-elect DeSantis's campaign pledge that he wants to see 80% of K through 12 education spending to be spent in the classroom? Now, critics of that proposal say it's just not realistic, that about half of the employees of schools are not teaching in the classroom. They're doing other things. What about that pledge from Governor-elect DeSantis? What's FEA's position on how classroom dollars are going to be spent in this administration?
Well, I want everybody to be clear about what that means. When the state legislature and the governor says that 80 to 85% of monies will go to the classroom, that is the government on high telling our local communities, our local, our parents, our superintendents, our school boards, what and when they can do and how they can do it. And that's not right. Our school system should be about local control. You know, grandparents know what their children need. School boards know what their children need. And each community is different, and they should be given the latitude to do that. We want more money into education, and then we want those levers of power to be as close to the students as humanly possible. And that starts with the school board and the superintendent. And so our superintendents all over this state, our school boards all over this state should be very, very concerned, because this is taking away their ability to make decisions that are best for their community.
So what does classroom spending mean for you? Does that mean teacher salaries, or does that mean solely instructional materials or technology? How does the FEA interpret the governor-elect's pledge of classroom spending?
Well, listen, school spending is all of the above. But again,
but
those
classroom
people
spending is what the governor's talked about. So is the FEA's position is that includes teacher salaries, for instance?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The teachers are in the classroom. That is absolutely a part of, and it has to be in the mix. The reason that it has to be in the mix is simply because this. In Florida, we know that our teachers are 45th in the nation in teacher pay.
And should that include public charter school teachers as well?
Well, I mean, that's a different conversation. Our position on charter schools is that we should be slowing down the expansions of charter schools. We should be talking about our traditional public schools and how to make those schools better.
And let me ask you one quick question before we wrap this up. Critics of the burgeoning charter school movement believe that it's a backdoor way to dismantle traditional public education in Florida. Do you agree or disagree with that notion?
So in the way that we've seen it in the last 10 years, absolutely. Absolutely, we agree with that, because they have been taking monies out of the public coffers to give to these charter schools who come in with management teams, who come in behind high-powered, out-of-town business center types of mindsets. You know, schools are unlike businesses. These are human beings we're talking about. This is not, you know, kids are not for sale. And we're talking about real estate, and we're talking about, you know, things that people are profiting from. And we should be talking about the edification of these children. What is going to make them successful? That's going to be art and band and choir and IB classes and smaller class sizes and getting high quality teachers in the classroom. We have missed that part of the conversation. That is the most important conversation we should be talking about. We should be talking about choice within the school system, choice within the public school system.
Does that include charters as a choice?
I believe charters have a place, but there should never be a replacement for the traditional public school system. And that's what we've seen. We've seen a parallel track of a competing school system. And education is not a competition. Kids get there when they get there. The light comes on at different times and different places and spaces. And teachers know this best. And our public school teachers is where we have all the regulations. We have all of the things that the state says they have to have. And we simply want to be treated fairly.
Frederick, we'll leave it there. We appreciate your time here. Frederick Ingram, head of the holiday break for public school teachers. He's president of the Florida Education Association. Thanks, Frederick.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your phone calls at 305-995-1800 coming up from Florida Public Radio.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, and thanks for being with us. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. When Ron DeSantis was running for governor, he credited Republican education reform efforts for improving schools here in the Sunshine State. Those reforms have included expanding choices for parents and students, like charter schools and using vouchers for private schools, and expanding the use of public money for such programs.
That's right. Now, as Speaker of the Florida House, Richard Corcoran supported all of those ideas. Now, he will be the top education official in the state under new Governor Ron DeSantis. So we're spending the full hour today looking at what that might mean for your public school district. Give us a call statewide as we talk about the future of public schools in Florida. The number to join us here on the Florida Roundup, 305-995-1800. That's 305-995-1800, or tweet the show at Florida Roundup. Already getting your tweets as we welcome John Kennedy, state capitol reporter for Gatehouse Media, and Andrew Atterbury. He is education reporter for Politico. Guys, thanks for being with us. John, let's begin with you. The other day, the governor-elect's Education and Workforce Development Committee had a phone conference where they talked about the future of public education in Florida, and they seem to offer every indication that we're going to see could be a full transformation of education in this state. That's been a trend for some years. It's one that's expected to accelerate. What did you take away from that phone conference as we heard remarks by Board of Education Chair Marva Johnson and others saying that the big focus is going to be on teacher compensation along with accountability and transparency and how public dollars are allocated towards schools? Your thoughts about what we're learning so far under this administration?
Well, I think that the for the Republicans, the stars are aligned on education right now, where you have somebody like Ron DeSantis, who is a big advocate of vouchers, a big advocate of charter schools. He has not said too much about traditional public schools. However, as you pointed out earlier during your conversations, he does want to increase the amount, the percentage of dollars that goes into Florida classrooms. But I think when it comes to words like accountability, transparency, we've been hearing that for many years. I think there could be a little bit of an effort to try to impose perhaps a little bit stricter standards on charter schools and vouchers, a little bit more testing, possibly, even though testing has gone has come under a lot of fire from parents and from educators as Florida is doing too much of it right now. But I think you're going to see efforts to try to expand the state's most prominent voucher program. That's the tax credit scholarship program. There's going to be an effort to try to expand that. Charters, I think it's open season. There's going to be probably another effort by legislators to try to get what had been ruled off the ballot this year. That was a proposal that would have allowed a state board to approve charter schools as opposed to local school districts being, playing a critical role in whether or not a charter school is allowed to create in a county. So I think all that is going to be happening in this coming legislative session.
Andrew, let me ask you, from your vantage point, what are the possible places where a Commissioner Corcoran is going to work with the Republican majority and the new Republican governor to expand those options, those choices that that John just articulated?
It's kind of interesting. The new commissioner has put himself in a position to kind of oversee a lot of the legislation that he helped get through. Now he's going to be able to see it implemented over the years. I think the Hope Scholarship is a big part. Schools of Hope also, which has kind of been – it seems like it's been kind of quiet lately, but I think that's all about to pick up. And that's the one where that was a really big piece of legislation where you can it set aside money for charter schools to open up next to low-performing schools. I don't – from what the state's told me, there haven't been any opened yet. But the state now is looking for I guess either a bank or some kind of institution to help them with their revolving loan program, which is where they're actually going to be able to – charter schools be able to get a little bit of money to help build these schools. Mm-hmm. And now that – I think that's coming to fruition probably this year. So we'll see probably the first couple of those, which is the way that it's kind of set up now where Mr. Corcoran put that – and that was all his idea. That was his baby. And now he's going to be the commissioner as it all comes to fruition. So I expect some more changes to that, but I think that's the one thing right now that I'm kind of keeping my eye on.
Lots of calls, lots of questions and comments around public education under the new governor, fellas. 305-995-1800. Let's begin in Tampa with Nestor on line four. Go ahead, Nestor. Thanks for calling in. Your thoughts.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I feel like we're always having this conversation about choice, but I struggle because we don't also have the conversation about access. To say parents all well and good, but how many of our parents don't have access to private schools or the charter schools? How can we talk about choice for all parents when all parents don't have the access to that choice?
Nestor, what do you mean by access?
So you'll have, if you are giving parents choice, you're saying you can go to whatever school you choose, but think about how poor communities or marginalized communities are stuck with the traditional schools because they don't have transportation to drop their kids off, or their employment doesn't allow for early pickups or drop-offs or any of those things. Oftentimes, choice seems to be associated with people with privilege and access to those schools.
Nestor, we got it. Choice and kind of mobility there in Tampa. And Andrew, I think, you know, he's getting kind of to the point and the justification that we heard from then-Speaker Corcoran around this HOPE scholarship to take those most severely underperforming, failing schools, most often in lower-income neighborhoods, and providing kind of a private enterprise potential solution to them.
Sure, and those tax credit scholarships, there is a portion of that for transportation. So, you know, if people could see that as a way into that as well lately. But there is actually a report this week that this is the first time in a long time that tax credit scholarship funding was down because of corporate tax, the way the corporate tax structures were. And I'm actually kind of curious to look a little bit more on that. But I know that there is a piece of that scholarship specifically for transportation, because that is a huge part. And even with the school choice legislation that opened the doors of traditional public schools to other districts, the problem is they always say, okay, our schools are too full, so we can't accept folks anyway. And that's been a huge problem that I've seen in some of the communities I've covered.
And with that tax credit scholarship program as well, you know, that the average family income for that is about $25,700 a year for a family of four. And there's 108,000 low-income children in that program. But I think there remains a view that there's this waiting list. But as Andrew pointed out, one of the problems with that program has been the corporate scholarships are declining. There's not enough companies that are steering money toward it. So that seems to be holding it back a little bit.
That's an interesting point to make as well. Thanks, John. And it's 305-995-1800. If you're just tuning in, we're spending the full hour on today's show taking your calls and tweets from around the state as we discuss the future of public education in Florida. What are the questions you have about your child's school district? Eric is in Jacksonville. He's on the line. Hi, Eric. You're on the Florida Roundup. Go ahead.
Hey, Melissa. Thanks for having me. Whenever we have this conversation, we have this really odd presupposition that permeates the whole argument on both sides, the Democrats and the Republicans, and it's around choice and parental choice. Well, what do parents want for their kids? Well, is this goal or you know, policy aim based on any sort of study or data that shows that whenever parents make decisions for their children about which school they should go to, their outcomes are better? Because the whole thing, you know, how is it that the parents know what's best for the kids? Recently, out west somewhere, I think it was in Washington State, they pushed the time at which kids went to school back an hour because the kids weren't getting enough sleep, and if the result was their test grades and performance went up 4 or 5%. So here were experts saying the circadian cycle of these students is being interrupted by this early start time, so let's set it back. And these experts were correct. Where is the science in this judgment that parents somehow know what's best for their kids when it comes to their education?
All right, Eric. That's Eric in Jacksonville. Thanks for that. Okay, John Kennedy, why don't you take that one? Of course, the charter school movement, certainly the public face of it, has been quite a few parents saying, we want different choices for our kids. When you look at the data, though, because as that caller just pointed out, let's look at science, let's look at data to see what is the best way to conduct this. And he is right about the fact that later start times, which is a simple change that some school districts around the country are making, has helped children, particularly high school children, perform better in school. But I guess his overriding question is it wise to leave this up to parents? What do you think about his point?
Gosh, well, I think Florida, like many states, you know, it goes toward local control when it comes to schools. And I guess nothing could be seen as more local than the role of the parent. But there is a question about, you know, how smart are the parents, I guess, how, you know, whether the direction that they're guiding students and the way school boards and the counties are guiding the programs, that is maybe in dispute when they're not infallible for certainly. But you're right about charter schools. Charter schools began as something of a rebellion against the rigidity of local control and local school districts. They began about 22 years ago in Florida, and now there's mm-hmm. almost 300,000 students in 655 charter schools. Now, the profit motive has moved into charters as well, because they are often run by for-profit companies, and whether they have the science of education behind them or not, I guess that's a question as well.
Questioning this assumption about do parents know what's best for their child's education is fascinating to think about, honestly. Mm-hmm. Never really thought of it that way, Eric, in Jacksonville, so I appreciate you bringing that up. I'll tell you, as a parent of a first-time parent of a 13-year-old, I'll honestly tell my teenager, this is the first time I've had a teenager, too, so sometimes I may screw up my parenting, so bear with me.
I think
a
lot of us can relate to that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go to Dave in Miami talking about charter schools and the role of parents there. Dave, you're on the radio. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for having me on your show. No, I just wanted to simply say this charter school business, it's plain and simply it's a tool or a means towards further corporate socialism. It is simply to close down the private sector school, the public sector schools, the public schools, privatize them, make them for profit, eliminate all opposition from teachers' unions, get a fearful and pliant workforce. Not to mention the fact that the charter schools themselves are not any better, and in fact, in many ways, worse than the public schools.
Worse than how, Dave? What kind of evidence do you have of that?
Well, the evidence that I have is this: they hire teachers without certification. They also, I remember there was a case here in South Florida several years ago where a charter school principal was caught giving and I believe it was your news agency that reported this, I believe it was WLRN that reported this first. They were, if not you, the Miami Herald, he was passing out this was back during the FCAT. He was passing out the FCAT test booklets to the students for them to read it beforehand.
Yeah, Dave, I hear you. And certainly a lot of opposition there to charter schools. Let me remind folks that
charter schools and cheating both start with a CH. That's all what it's about.
Well, okay, fair enough. You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
Okay, lots of calls. We'll get to those in just a moment. But first, let's get a few of your tweets on the air. You can tweet the show anytime at Florida Roundup. Malik says, how will chronic underfunding of the Department of Corrections interplay with the chronic underfunding of public education in Florida? Talking about the criminal justice system and how that relates to our educational outcomes. And he goes on to say, especially with Florida on pace to add 1 million residents every 3 years or so, how will we manage increases in students that speak other languages in our public schools? We'll continue to talk about that, too, as Florida continues to grow all the time and how schools are managing that. First, though, let's go to a few more of your calls. 305-995-1800 on the Florida Roundup. Dana is in Spring Hill. Hi, Dana. You're on the air. What are your thoughts about this?
Well, my son attends a charter school in Spring Hill, Florida, but I'm also a public school teacher, and I have a ton of research, and your previous caller is wrong. Individual charter schools should be looked at individually, just like any individual person. But if you're going to look at really renovating education and changing what we need to do and servicing our most impoverished children, have you all ever heard of the Harlem Children's Zone in New York? It has two centers now, and it's run by Gregory Canada. That school is one of the most phenomenal, innovative schools in the nation and needs to be looked at as a model. And if what we're going to do in Florida is anything that this school is what we should model our school after, where they have doctors on campus and they have an eye doctor on campus and they have training classes for parents and they have after-school programs, mentorships, and they guarantee college education paid by the school for their children who graduate. That is what our most impoverished neighborhoods need. And if we want to make the United States and put a level playing field on all of our children, we need to give them an education, and it starts there. And if education is not valued in the home, it's not valued by the child. And that's what our schools need to look at. It's not about teachers. It's not about test scores. It's about getting to the child and educating that child and giving them a chance for a better opportunity in the United
States. And Dana, let me ask, what do you teach?
Well, right now I'm teaching ELA, which is ELL, however you call it in your county, English Language Learners. But I've been a teacher 25 years. Mm-hmm. I've worked for the Department of Defense overseas. I've worked in Florida. So I'm very well-rounded and versed in knowing what needs to be done in education. Nobody at the state level understands that.
And I so appreciate the call. It's good to hear from teachers. You know, Dana, I am familiar with the Harlem Children's Zone in New York, and that whole model has been tried in other places, including here in Jacksonville, where I'm sitting. It's called the Newtown Success Zone. It's modeled on the Harlem Children's Zone, and it's a cradle-to-college approach where not only are a lot more resources going into the schools, they're going into the neighborhoods around the schools so as to really wrap arms around the kids and their parents. You know, the challenge, of course, is funding. How you get additional revenue not only into the schools but also into the neighborhood programs that are intended to sort of buttress and support the kids. And I think you've hit on such an important point, Dana. What happens in the classroom is so important, but then what happens outside of the classroom, socioeconomic factors are also driving student performance. So I really appreciate the call as we talk about this. Thanks for that call. That's Dana in Spring Hill. Thanks for being on the Florida Roundup. Okay, here's another tweet. Not a penny of tax money should be spent on schools other than regular public schools. Andrew Atterbury, just a minute till we get to the break. I think where you stand on this issue of how we fund education explains how a lot of people stand politically, whether they're liberal or conservative.
Andrew, I'm going to have you hold off on that because we got to go to break now. We'll collect your phone calls and that answer from Andrew about school funding next on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Lots of calls and tweets as we talk about the future of public education in Florida with new education commissioner Richard Corcoran. Just like Governor-elect Ron DeSantis, he is a fan of school choice and expanding charters in the state. Andrew Atterbury, as we were saying before the break, it's fascinating to get the feedback coming in on Twitter and from callers. Education is a dividing line politically, where you stand on how we fund education. And let me ask you about that. We got a tweet before the break saying we shouldn't spend any money on schools other than regular public schools. Well, not everyone agrees anymore on what a regular public school is in the state of Florida.
No, absolutely not. And some of the legislators now, they think that the money should fall, like the per student funding should follow the kid wherever the parent and the child decides to go. So that's something that we're probably going to see a lot more of lately. But it kind of – and another thing that they mentioned on that on the Governor-elect DeSantis' his conference call this week was somebody said that they should just, hey, let's just increase the base funding per student, which is something that a lot of folks will say because they think that'll pump more money into classrooms. Then on the other side, there's people who say you could put as much money as you want into a school and that doesn't prove whether or not it's going to be successful. The questions I have, I think, and this kind of touches on what we spoke about a second ago, was wraparound services to schools, things that – how does this all fit into the governor-elect's plans to put 80% of money into the classroom? Does that mean school psychologists are going to take a hit? There was a huge push after the Parkland shooting to increase funding for mental health. Is that in jeopardy because it's not technically in the classroom? Mm-hmm. Callers talked about how much the student is affected outside the classroom and all that stuff. It does come into the classroom. So there's a huge question now, I think, on – and that was that was a lot of what the conference call this week focused on. What exactly is in the classroom spending? Because even though a psychologist probably never steps foot in a classroom, the effect they have on this child is going to be huge for what they do in the classroom. And that's something we're going to have to figure out here pretty soon.
And arguably, right, even, you know, the roof, the air conditioning, does it leak? Does it work? How, you know, the windows? I mean, all of that, John Kennedy, could be arguably the capital spending required to keep some of these older schools in decent enough shape so that kids can have a decent enough learning environment. All that could be considered classroom spending, couldn't it?
Oh, more or less. I think when it comes to the debate, they're going to have to, you know, define the terms that they're going to be arguing over, because right now DeSantis coming in, you know, he says he wants 80%. He claims that 74% by his math is what is currently spent in the classroom of education dollars. So that leaves, as he describes it, a $1.4 billion difference. Like he would increase school funding by that amount. That's, you know, a significant amount of dollars.
Without raising taxes or
without raising taxes sources. And yeah, without any, you know, major overhaul. But you're right about it. When it comes to any kind of a school choice program, there is such a divide in the state. When Corcoran was nominated and eventually elected by the State Board of Education, which, you know, I'll use the term rubber stamped Ron DeSantis's recommendation. The debate over that, the various interests that came up and spoke for or against Corcoran, you could have had that same debate 20 years ago when Governor Jeb Bush was governor, because this fight has been going on over whether these alternate programs are designed simply to you know, starve the traditional public schools, divert state tax money toward these other entities, whether they be for-profit or just alternate programs. That argument seems to have not let up. And it was part of the last governor's race that we just concluded, that Ron DeSantis won by less than 34,000 votes. But, you know, anything that Democrat Andrew Gillum was arguing for, the return of the defense of public traditional public schools, that argument seems to have gone out the window. And DeSantis might as well have won by 3 million votes as far as how much that's being talked about now.
Yeah. Andrew Gillum, a big part of his campaign platform was that every teacher in Florida should make a minimum of $50,000 a year. That argument did not win the day, of course, as we continue to talk about public education in Florida. You're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Lots of calls about this from across the state. It's 305-995-1800 to join us. Pat is in Tampa. She's got some thoughts about how this issue has been studied. Hey, Pat, you're on the air.
Hi. I am with the League of Women Voters of Florida, and we have done a five-year study on charter schools and their effects on children. And the facts are indisputable, starting with the fact that principals don't even have to have a high school diploma to be a principal of a charter school. They offer almost no electives for middle school students. They are not required to provide transportation, so needy children really can't get to charter schools. They require expensive uniforms, embroidered expensive uniforms.
Right. Some of them do. So let me ask you, Pat, what were the study's ultimate findings when it comes to just results, how students are doing academically when you do a head-to-head comparison of charter schools versus traditional public schools?
That has been done by Stanford University. They do a Credo study every 3 years, and what they found is that in the cities, charter schools are not performing as well as public schools, and that the only benefit to charter schools is for some African-American children to do slightly better in reading. But when you compare apples to apples, they are not succeeding in excellent education.
That's Pat in Tampa. And Pat, thank you for pointing out that the League of Women Voters of Florida also studied this and talked about, you know, just how charter schools receive public funds but aren't always held to the same accountability standards and rules as traditional public schools. I think that's kind of what you were getting at a little bit with some of the data points in that study. That's Pat in Tampa. Thank you for that call, Pat. So, John Kennedy, what about that? When you look at the hard data on this, Stanford University, a study done here in the state, how do you see this data meeting against the political reality, which is very pro-charter in Florida.
Yeah, I think charters are here to stay. I don't think there's going to be any rollback of any kind. Data is questioned about how successful they may be, or all of them may be. You know, some of them do go out of business. Some of them do get, you know, their charters pulled by the county for various failings. I think there is a certain sentiment about coming out of this Republican legislature that maybe this is a time for trying to unshackle traditional public schools a little bit, give them a little bit more authority to, try different approaches that would be almost like, you know, a charter within the public school, maybe. Mm. Currently charters are public schools, but mm-hmm. I think it's a little bit hard to say exactly where it could go, but I think there is a rising acknowledgement among Republican leaders in this state right now that the playing field is not level anymore, that public schools must do so many things. They have so many basic tasks that they must do that it's very easy to favor charter or voucher schools.
John, let's hear from a charter school parent here. William in Brandon is joining us now on the roundup. William, go ahead. You've got a daughter at a charter school?
She goes to Bridge Prep here in Riverview, and when I was looking for a school for my daughter, I chose this. Now, my choice was based on my personal education. I'm a bachelor degree nurse. It was on my experience of going to public school as a child. It was based on my experiences in life. So to say that I don't have the right or the ability to choose for my daughter seems a little over the top.
Hmm.
But that being said, my daughter was in a program in which all religions were displayed. There was nobody saying anything. It was a beautiful program. There was no drawback because it was a religious program or not a religious program. There's so many different things. She takes a Spanish class every day as an elementary student in this school. So she's learning to be bilingual. I find there are value in things that you're not talking about, the uniform thing. Our kids don't fight about who's wearing the nicest clothes.
But William, there are public schools that require uniforms too. There are public schools that have bilingual education every day. So what's the differentiating fact for you? And are you confident that the teachers and the administrators in the charter school have the certification and the licensing that traditional public schools are required to have?
Well, let's go through. You said, why was it, you know, all these things, why is it a choice for me? Well, my daughter's biracial. When I walk into this school, it is a multitude of just different races, creeds, religions. No one is placed above or below anyone. Everybody is there by choice. So it's not because of where they live or who they live by mm-hmm. or any of that. We're all there by choice. As far as certifications and all like that, I'm an active parent. I'm a single dad who has a 8-year-old daughter. I contact that school at least on a weekly basis, sometimes on a daily basis. We are constantly talking. We're looking at it. My daughter was given an opportunity to test for, I don't know what they call it, like the exceptional student.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the program is in Florida. She tested for it. She takes a little extra class here and there.
William,
it's just a great opportunity for me, but it was my choice.
Absolutely.
That's all I'm
saying. Yeah, no, we
now,
get it.
I
yeah.
pay taxes.
Our time is tight here, William. I'm sorry. We can do a lot of things here on the radio, but we can't stop the clock here. William and Brandon,
hey,
thank you.
You guys have a wonderful day.
You too. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to you there in the Gulf Coast. Appreciate that.
And he sums up how so many parents feel, guys. They want the choice.
Yeah, they do. All right, John Kennedy, happy holidays to you and yours. State Capitol reporter for Gatehouse Media with us from our sister station in Tallahassee, WFSU, Andrew Atterbury, education reporter at Politico. Fellas, thanks so much for wading through all of this when it comes to public education. Committee meetings start early in the new year, so watch this space, as they say. Thanks, fellas. Happy New Year.
Thanks for being here.
Oh, hey, thank you guys for talking about education. It's something that I think
about. That's our show and the Florida Roundup produced by WJCT in Jacksonville, WLRN in Miami. Alex Gonzalez, Heather Schatz, producers.
Jason Zabka is our technical director and the director of radio programming. Theme music provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at AaronLibos.com. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for being with us. We'll be back next week.